can take a look at Alaska's natural gas situation and pretty much scale it up to the whole world. The gas supply is up, but it's not where the demand is. But that doesn't make the cost of a pipeline to go anywhere but up. Good morning, and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Our statewide phone number is 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Our federal gas line coordinator, Larry Pursley, has a background as a journalist and is here to help work through the confusion about gas today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, Larry Pursley, federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, is back and forth between Washington, D.C. and Alaska. Right now he's in Washington, but he joins us by digital link, so it'll sound like he's right in the room with us. Larry, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, it's good to have you on and good to have you available to go through this as the... I wouldn't say that we're coming to decision time, but there are some issues on the table in front of the state legislature with regards to a smaller scale in-state gas pipeline that, they may decide to advance. And they're also taking a little bit closer look than they had been as to how the AGIA money has been spent and is being spent by TransCanada. And so those are just a couple of the current issues. Everybody knows if there is a gas line, it's some years in the future, but there seem to be several possible gas lines. The latest one I guess I would ask you about is a Parks Highway route and what that might mean. Apparently, this is in the public lands bill again, as it was in the last Congress. It didn't quite get through both houses, but in this case, it's thought that it might. And this is language that allows a pipeline right of way through Denali National Park, which apparently would pave the way between, let's say, Fairbanks and Cook Inlet, as opposed to North Slope and Valdez.
Well, actually, Steve, you can get from Fairbanks to Cook Inlet without going through the park. This legislation, which Senator Murkowski has been working on, would let you go through the park on that side of the highway rather than the other side. What the intent is to get gas into the park facilities. So instead of burning diesel, they could burn natural gas. But you can go outside the park boundary and still get south into Cook Inlet with gas. But, you know, there is an advantage certainly to the park to getting clean burning natural gas instead of diesel. And it's easier if you're on that side of the highway.
Oh, I see. So that's all there is to it. There would be a right-of-way on the other side anyway.
Right. The legislation would allow the natural gas pipeline right-of-way through the park land on that side of the highway.
And the park likes that.
Yeah, the National Park Service likes the idea of cleaner air and getting natural gas instead of diesel.
Well, I am very happy to promote the website of the federal coordinator. It's got all these white papers on it, and they're written by Bill White. Did you decide to call them white papers because of that?
No, we used to call them issue papers, but realized they really are white papers, aside for the play on Bill's name. We're trying to, while we're waiting for a project, waiting for permits, to try to get as much information out there as we can to Alaskans, to other interested parties on what's going on in natural gas markets nationally, in the Pacific Rim, internationally. Project competition for Alaska, what's going on in pricing in the markets. And we, as you say, do a series of these white papers. We've got a couple more coming out in the next few weeks. One will look at how you finance a multi-billion dollar project. We're taking five recent LNG export projects in Australia, Louisiana, Papua New Guinea, I forget the other two, Qatar in the Middle East, and trying to tell the story of how you put together the financing, who loans money, who invests money. We're also putting together one on the natural gas liquids content of Prudhoe Bay gas that would be fed into a pipeline. Pieces that it really does help if you understand it, understand how all of these pieces fit together for the Alaska project, how they affect the economics of it, the marketing, and such.
Well, I was trying to work my way through the complicated question of the Prudhoe Bay reservoirs. And because the gas is now used to repressurize the reservoirs, there's no question but once you start taking quite a lot of gas out of that gas field and it can't be used to repressurize, it's also going to have an influence on how much oil is being produced. Is that, you know, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has been looking at that, but the actual numbers that they're using, according to the white paper, are really old.
Right, because no one has filed an application with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to take gas off Prudhoe Bay to put into a pipeline. So the numbers they have before them are pretty old from years ago. But the good thing is any offtake of gas out of that reservoir is going to have to be approved by the State Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And their job is to make sure we get the best recovery we can of the hydrocarbons of oil and gas for Alaska. So the companies, if BP, Conoco, Exxon were to go ahead, for example, with a large-scale pipeline, they'd have to present their plan to the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. They'd have to explain to the reservoir engineers, show them the geology of what they're going to do so that you can take off the gas, but you lose as little oil as possible. For example, the Prudhoe Bay gas is very rich in carbon dioxide, almost 13%. So if the big project were to go ahead, they would strip out that CO2 on the North Slope at the treatment plant and use those 500 million cubic feet a day of carbon dioxide re-injected underground to help pressurize the field, to help force out more oil. They may also look at water injection. They would present their case to the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission as to how they intend to get the gas out without, you know, without harming oil recovery any more than is absolutely necessary. Also keep in mind, Prudhoe Bay has been pumping 36 years. By the time a gas line is built, maybe 8, 9, 10 years from now, there'll be that much less oil. So as time has gone on, the risk to hurting oil recovery diminishes, but that's still something the state is going to look at before anybody can take gas out.
Yeah, you know, often I find when you really start drilling down into the details of things, you discover some of this they haven't really handed to the engineers yet. And until the engineers get a hold of it, the numbers they look solid, but they tend to change once somebody actually has to figure out how to really do it. I think we're seeing that right now with Point Thompson, which theoretically would bring another large gas field online. But to do that, first they have to do the construction of the pipeline to get to Badami. And then once it gets to Badami, apparently there's a transaction that would take place to allow the liquids to improve the quality of the recovery at Badami of the crude oil. And so it goes. Then there's an existing pipeline that goes on to Prudhoe Bay. But for right now, you know, that's all a gas liquids play because that's all they can really do.
Right. And I think the professional staff at the State Oil and Gas Commission, Conservation Commission, they're very knowledgeable on what they do. And I guess I put a lot of faith in their ability to ensure a maximum recovery for Alaska of oil and gas from whether it's Point Thompson, Prudhoe Bay, or any other field up there.
And this is the commission that, among other people, has had on it Randy Riedrich and Sarah Palin?
Well, I'm talking about current staff.
Okay.
That's my polite answer.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. We're talking with Larry Persily, Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. Larry doesn't really have any kind of axe to grind, but he is pretty much of a straight shooter, and he's here to help people understand these issues. And we're happy to take your calls and engage in conversation about any of these issues, especially the large diameter pipeline. So we got one large diameter pipeline that looks like is sort of phased out, the AGEA Trans-Canada into Alberta one, and now it seems to be more a large diameter gas line that would somehow rush Fairbanks and get down to Valdez, maybe.
Well, Valdez or somewhere on Tidewater, the companies are looking at, they started with 22 potential sites for the liquefaction plant at Tidewater. They've narrowed it down to 4 or 5 potential sites. They have not publicly disclosed where they are, other than to say they would be in Cook Inlet or Prince William Sound. But you're right, the project that TransCanada and ExxonMobil had been working on the last few years to bring Alaska natural gas through Canada to serve the lower 48 states, North American market, that has been put back into binders and put on the shelf. With all the shale gas production in the lower 48, there is no need whatsoever at this time to send Alaska gas to the lower 48. So you've got Exxon, TransCanada, BP, Conoco joined them about a year ago, and the four companies are looking at the feasibility, the economics of taking Alaska gas off the slope to Tidewater, liquefying it, and sending it to Asia markets. And they got together a year ago in March 2012. Between then and January of this year, they spent about $25 million, and hopefully they'll continue to spend more as they ramp up their work into preliminary engineering, environmental work, and such. That's the hope.
Do you think that the oldest liquefied natural gas plant in the United States is actually right at Nikiski, and essentially the owners are saying we there's not enough gas anymore, we're not planning on renewing our license? And they're working on extensions anyway. And there's talk of trying to convert that to an import plant, oddly, because NSTAR has to continue somehow supplying the gas needs of their consumers. So this is the Cook Inlet situation. I'm wondering if there's ever going to be a white paper on how easy it is to convert an export facility to import facility.
Well, probably not. I mean, it can be done. That's what you're seeing in the lower 48. There are billions of dollars spent in the last 10 years by companies building LNG import terminals when they thought North America was going to run out of gas. Shale gas comes along. We're not importing any LNG to speak of into lower 48. Those companies, after sinking billions of dollars into the import terminals, are now applying for federal permission to export gas. They want to add an export capability to the plant. You can do it. I'm not an engineer, but it can be done. I don't know the cost, and I'm not privy to proprietary information at ConocoPhillips, which owns the Nikiski plant, and certainly the utilities. That would be up to them to work with Conoco if, in fact, they wanted to use that plant for imports, to try to figure out what's involved, what the cost would be. But you could modify a plant to do both, to export and import, depending on what the needs are in any given day. It's how much do you want to spend, how much land is available, what equipment would have to be modified or added. But as you say, the utilities, NSTAR, Chugach Electric, Municipal Light and Power, Matanuska Electric, are concerned, what if there are not enough, if there's not enough new gas reserves found and produced out of Cook Inlet to meet South Central utility needs? Would they be put in a position where they would have to import liquefied natural gas into South Central to serve their customers in the years ahead? And that's something they have spent a lot of time considering, and I believe they're still considering it.
Larry Pursley is our guest, and Larry, you're doing great. I want to throw one more thing, confusing factor, into the picture before we start with our phone calls, which are piling up right now.
Okay, it's not going to do anything about baseball predictions, is it, for this year?
Hey, it was looking pretty good for the Mariners compared to previous years anyway. But no, it's
okay, good.
It's this one here. The shale gas and fracking. It's really political.
It is.
It seems that some or maybe all environmental groups are pressing Wyden and Murkowski to put a lid on exports of natural gas. Don't allow it. And of course, Alaska is almost sits as the outlier in all this. But their concern seems to be environmentally is everybody knows the carbon footprint of natural gas is actually less than coal and less than crude oil, but they don't like the fracking, and they're hoping to stop it or curtail it or whatnot, and that would change the whole supply-demand situation for all this weird shale gas and shallow gas and all these things.
That's true. You've got a lot of environmental groups that have written to the Department of Energy. They are opposing liquefied natural gas exports from the lower 48. Not that they're that concerned about the economics or the mechanics of it, but they see that U.S. lower 48 exports of gas would give a market for gas produced by fracking. So their theory is if you shut off the market, then fracking would decline, and so that's why they're against it. The good thing, though, for Alaska is we're not part of that debate right now. There is...
Well, you don't think we could be unintended consequences?
No, I don't think so at the moment. The Department of Energy study that came out in December on the economic impact of lower 48 exports specifically excluded Alaska. And Senator Begich, Senator Murkowski both had contacted the Department of Energy to make sure Alaska would be excluded from that study, because the whole thing the Department of Energy is looking at right now is if you take lower 48 gas, send it overseas as LNG exports, what will that do to the domestic price, the domestic supply of natural gas? Since Alaska is not connected to lower 48, it's immaterial. We're not part of that debate because our gas is not part of the lower 48 supply. So the Energy Department review does not deal with Alaska, which is good. Energy Department has not accepted any application for Alaska LNG exports. They don't have one before them at the moment. So you're right. It's a very contentious battle going on with fracking. That's the other thing. The gas from the North Slope is conventional. It's not involved. Doesn't involve fracking and all that controversy. So it's a loud political argument in Lower 48 that for now we're not part of, and if we can stay out of it, so much the better.
Keep our heads down. All right, Larry, you ready for some calls?
Sure.
All right. Bob joins the program from Sol.na. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. And yes, confusing is, I'd say, probably the most dominant thing of this whole natural gas debacle we seem to have in our state. You know, I was just a young man when the pipeline was finished, and they talked about building a gas line. We had the right-of-ways established when they built the TAPS line, and now we're studying all this again. You know, we have a bill in the House, HB4, for an in-state gas line. We have other factions that want to build a larger diameter gas line to Tidewater to Valdez. You know, I remember when I was 20 years old, I worked in the State House, and I remember what somebody told me. What was it? I'm sure you've heard that you can't dazzle them with brilliance, baffle them with BS. And, you know, we're going in so many different directions, it seems like. And I'm 54 years old now. I keep seeing my NSTAR bill get higher and higher. I use $30 or $40 worth of gas, and by the time I get done adding supplier charges and all this stuff onto it, I'm looking at a $150 bill. And that's nothing compared to, you know, well, we all know the interior and outlying villages, and they have nothing. They use stove oil, and we all know that they're paying more for stove oil than for gasoline, just because people that provide it to them know they have to have it, so they charge them thus. You know, and the way things are looking, I'm wondering, in my lifetime, if I'll ever see a gas line in the state that gives gas, that people can have gas and have cheap energy. You know, you talked about pressurizing. They used the gas to pressurize the wells up in Prudhoe Bay because once they put seawater down there to do that, like they do in some places, the well is pretty much done. But they flare off that gas, if I'm not stuff, if I'm correct. And they probably flare off enough gas in a day to run the whole city of Soldotna for a month.
You know, I honestly don't know. So in other words, Bob, you're kind of pushing the bullet line. Is that the idea?
Well, I'm pushing for something, Steve.
Something! Please!
Well, come on, Steve, let's get her done. I mean, no, Larry, I was outside. I went out to see the Northwest and stuff. I was gone. I think I left in 82. And there was going to be a gas line built, and I worked at a dealership up in Fairbanks. We had contracts on these for this company. Northwest Natural Gas, I think it was. They had orange trucks, and man, it was going to go. And I went outside, and I come back here in 99, and I expected to see a warm utopia, and everybody would be happy here, and we had cheap energy. I felt like the crying, the commercial back in the 70s with Chief, I can't remember what his name was, but he's an Indian gentleman.
Yes.
Riding a horse down along the side of the freeway with
the tear
in his eye.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right, Bob. Hey, Larry, you got thoughts on that? I mean,
sure. A few things I go through. The flaring of gas that occurs on the North Slope is for safety, is for pressure relief. There is no waste gas. There's no flaring of waste. I will say, and this is something Alaskans should think about, in North Dakota, where they're producing so much oil, they're producing oil and coming up with a lot of associated gas, but they have no pipelines to put the gas into. North Dakota's laws are different. North Dakota last year flared, burned off about a third of the gas that they produced. North Dakota burned off on an average day last year more gas than all of South Central Alaska uses, MLNP, Chugach, NSTAR, and the rest. So when you're talking about wasteful flaring, it's North Dakota. It's not Alaska. A few other things. Yes, people have been waiting for a gas line out of Alaska for 40 years, ever since we found oil and gas up on the North Slope. Truth is, until the last few years ago, you would have lost money on it. The price at the end of the pipe, whether it's in Asia for LNG or North America, the price up until these past several years has never been high enough to cover the cost of building that pipeline, moving the gas, liquefying it, and such.
Well, it's still ain't all that great. It's not all that great at the Henry Hub, is it?
Well, Henry Hub, which is the U.S. lower 48 benchmark, is now almost $4 per 1,000 cubic feet, double of what it was a year ago, but still not $4 is not enough to pay off for Alaska gas. The better market does appear to be in Asia. Yes, House Bill 4, the in-state gas line bill, is up this week in House Finance. Many people see that as an insurance plan. If the time comes where it's clear a big line is not going to be built, then maybe the state puts in some money and builds something, but that's a policy call for legislators and for the public. Do they want to borrow money, put state money into it, or is there any hope that the producers will put their own $65 billion at risk and build a big line? The bigger the line, the cheaper the gas is that's delivered to Alaskans. And the last thing on gas prices in South Central, we've been living and enjoying low-cost gas up until the last several years. For a long time in South Central, those were old gas discoveries. There's just, given the cost of exploration and production in 2010 and 2020, tomorrow's gas will not and cannot be as cheap as the gas was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's just economics. But hopefully, if a big pipeline or a pipeline can get built and you get some economies of scale and you can get some gas down to South Central, and if Cook Inlet discoveries, Cook Inlet exploration turns up some more gas, you'd have gas, but it's going to be more expensive than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Bob?
One more thing before I go, and I thank you for taking my call. How can we put a cost on taking care of our own people here in Alaska? Thank you very much.
All right, Bob. Thank you very much. I think we should throw in that Dan Fauske of the, now they're calling it the ASAP project, has put in a report to the legislature now and saying, well, we've got about $70 million so far been put into this, and here's our report on what it would take. But I think you're right. This is more of a backup right now. There wouldn't be a decision on it this year.
No, but the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, which is the state entity developing the plan for an in-state line, which goes by the name ASAP, Alaska Standalone Pipeline, they've gotten about $70, $75 million from the legislature. They say they need another $325 million, that it will cost $400 million total in state dollars to come up with the engineering, the environmental work, the permits to see if, in fact, they have a project that pencils out.
That's quite a chunk of change.
Well, it's like Susitna. We never do anything cheap, and we never do anything small here.
Let's go to Tom, joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good.
Hey, so I'm curious, is wouldn't we be able to use some of this natural gas to power some of the federal state vehicles that we have around here?
Well, I think that's going to be coming anyway, but there's a question of the takeout points and how it gets delivered and stuff like that. What can you add to that, Larry?
Well, to build a natural gas fueling station for vehicles, trucks, cars, buses, whatever, a lot are being built in the lower 48, full natural gas fueling stations. And I'm told they cost $500,000 to $1 million each. That's, I guess the question is, before anybody invests in a gas fueling station, they got to know there's enough vehicles that are going to come there and refuel. So it's the chicken and egg cliche. Do you build a fueling station and hope the trucks and buses and garbage trucks and vehicles convert, or do you wait for people to convert to a natural gas-fueled vehicle and then build the stations? You're going to have to build the stations first, and that's what we're seeing a lot in the lower 48, and I hope it comes to Alaska too. It's cleaner, it's cheaper, so hopefully we will see more of that in the years ahead. But you're going to have fueling stations.
Tom?
Yeah, okay. Instead of exporting all this fuel away, we're down here in Southeast, and we're paying god-awful amount for diesel, and it just seems like if we can get it transported throughout the state, we might be doing better.
Yeah, that's going to be reflected by a number of calls, I think, Larry.
Of course it would be, but then you've got to look at the cost of liquefying that gas, getting a fleet of barges or tanks on barges to get it down. Then you're going to have a regasification facility in each town if you're going to turn it back into gas to pipe to people, or storage to keep it super chilled, keep it liquid, and refueling stations. So, hey, I don't know anybody's against it. I think it's just a matter of how do you pay for it when it's just a small market.
And in some ways, Cook Inlet.
Infrastructure question there, huh?
Right. It really comes down to, how much would it cost to build that transportation system if you're going to have a liquefaction plant, say in Cook Inlet or Valdez, a system of delivery barges or ships or tankers or 40-foot thermos bottles that sit on top of a barge, bring them down to communities. If you're talking about selling liquefied natural gas to put into vehicles, you've got to have storage facilities in each town that can keep that in a liquefied natural gas state, which is, minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit. You've got to have a fueling system. So it's going to be the infrastructure costs.
All right, Tom. Thanks for your call. It's, by the way, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage, 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. Our guest is Larry Pursley, Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, with an S. And there are a ton of them. I think maybe we should just clarify that the demand of Cook Inlet, in total, all of it, everything, power plants, people burning gas, and so forth, is nowhere near enough to generate the kind of financing would be needed for a gas line, period.
No, I mean, you could build a project to serve that market, but the demand is so little, you could never afford to pay the fee to use a pipeline.
Yeah. So the
And Cook Inlet's covering it right now. Certainly in the years ahead, there's the concern that you may have to top the tank in Cook Inlet if it continues to fall short. But right, our problem, we're much like Hawaii. We have a very small market, and we're very geographically isolated, and that may cost very high. Fairbanks talks about paying $24 per 1,000 cubic feet for gas, liquefied natural gas that is trucked up from the Mat-Su. In Hawaii, they burn a synthetic natural gas that's produced on the islands. They're paying $40 per 1,000 cubic feet. It's just, the 49th and 50th states have some real tough energy issues.
Yeah, and then you look over to the Asian market, the growing Asian market, especially with Japan, you know, not knowing where it's going to go on nuclear now. And you're seeing, you know, they're paying vastly more than they're paying in the lower 48 for gas right now.
Right, they are. Traditionally, natural gas, liquefied natural gas delivered to Japan has been priced against the BTU equivalent of oil because that was their option, either burn natural gas or burn oil. So it made sense to some people years ago to price it that way, and that certainly was tolerable when oil was $15, $20, $30, $40 a barrel. At $110 a barrel, that becomes very expensive, liquefied natural gas, and Japan has said, no, we can't afford it. After the Fukushima nuclear disaster, when Japan shut down nuclear plants, had to burn a lot more natural gas to run their power generation needs. That year in 2011, Japan ran its first trade deficit in 31 years, in great part because of the huge tab, the huge bill they were paying for liquefied natural gas imports.
Fascinating. We're speaking with Larry Pursley as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Crowley, committed to Alaska for nearly 60 years. From basketball games to sled dog races, Crowley supports events that bring Alaskans together. Crowley supports what matters, and public radio matters. CPDAlaska.com.
It's Talk of Alaska, the subject, Alaska's natural gas, the guest, Larry Pursley, Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. And I'm reminded by Tom, by email, that Mira Kohler was on not too long ago saying, we want to build a power plant up on the North Slope and burn that gas right up there and deliver it by power line. And he says, so let's remember that and then think about whether Alaska has royalty gas that could be used for such a project. And I guess that would be the case. Alaska would theoretically have a royalty right to a certain percent of the gas that is now being reinjected.
Well, if the gas is produced, right, 12.5% belongs to the state, and we have a choice of taking ownership of the gas or letting the producer sell it and giving us a check. But you're right, once they start producing, we get 12.5%. Pretty much, within the law, we can do what we want with it, but there is the proposal out there to put a big power plant on the slope and then build transmission lines across Alaska to bring electricity to Alaska instead of gas. And that's great for your light bill. It's not going to do much for your space heating needs in Fairbanks unless you're going to convert your home to all electric. But it's another one of the proposals out there.
Let's go to Harry, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Harry.
Good morning.
It's Mr. Crawford.
Hi there.
How you doing?
I feel good, and the sun's shining, and the sky is blue,
yep.
And we've still got an awful lot of gas on the North Slope that needs to get to market.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, we've been struggling for years and years, ever since we built the oil pipeline, thinking that there was a day not in the not-too-distant future that we'd be building a gas line. I believe that the only thing that made sense then and still makes sense today is that we build our own industry here in Alaska to take at least a portion of our natural gas and have the value-added industry and the jobs that come with it and the stability that comes with it much the same as we did with Agrium nearly 40 years ago. We need to build plants here that that run on natural gas and use the natural gas byproducts, the liquids and all, to build our own industries and our own stability.
So your otherwise, thinking is that we should be thinking of this as a resource that we can use and do all sorts of value added with it. And I know this is not, you know, you've been saying this for a while too.
I'm on the Chugach Electric Board. We're going to have to make a decision shortly as to what we're going to do to continue to power our power plants, because the cheap gas in Cook Inlet is gone. There's more gas out there, but it's not ever going to be cheap again. And we've got these huge supplies on the North Slope. Why don't we go ahead and build our own industries here? I had a bill in the legislature to do a 35% tax credit for any new industry that came in and used Alaska's natural resources, basically pointed towards gas. I wasn't able to get that out of a committee because it seems as though there's some opposition by the majors. They don't want our hydrocarbons into the marketplace because it dilutes their pricing. So
yeah, I can see that. And Larry, I would think that you wouldn't really argue with that. I mean, it's not like the producers have their priorities.
Well, the producers have assets all over the world, in Alaska too. They would like to, I believe they would like to get a pipeline built so they can finally book the value, put the value of Alaska North Slope gas onto their balance sheets. It's, you know, the companies, oil and gas companies are always looking for new reserves, new oil, new gas that they can put onto their balance sheet to show the shareholders, to show the stock market that they are replacing the barrels and the cubic feet of gas they're taking out of the ground. So they want to, but yes, when you're looking for $65 billion, you got to compete with everything else that's going on out there. But, you know, former Representative Crawford's right. If there's a project that moves gas from the North Slope through Alaska into Tidewater, if there's any way possible to build industries in Alaska off of that, that's great. The key is, with a big line, since most of the gas is going to go somewhere else, that means someone else is going to pay most of the mortgage on that pipeline. It brings down the cost of those molecules of gas that stay in Alaska so we can do something with it and make a profit. Hopefully that's the way it goes.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that. I was thinking about that Agrium. You know, it actually wasn't feasible at the market price of gas. They had to have pretty cheap gas in order to make that fertilizer plant economic.
Well, it's true. After they had the infrastructure in place, it was cheap, and cheap for decades. And that would be the same case here for North Slope gas. What we've got to do is get that infrastructure built. And, you know, we have a ready market in places like Japan right now if we want to go in partnership, because the story has always been with natural gas that the money to be made in natural gas is not to own the gas, it's to transport the gas. That's where the real profit is. And if we were to set it up so that the market in Japan or other places were part owners in the transportation of it, so that they benefited from that, when we put our own industries here that took a portion of of that product, well, I believe that we could get this job done. But it's going to take some leadership, and it's going to take some people in the legislature to step forward and say, you know, it's time to do it, and let's stop dilly-dallying and build this thing.
So AGEA doesn't do the job.
No, AGEA, its time has come and gone as far as the pipeline to the lower 48, unless maybe you're talking about several decades down the road.
Well, they're trying to take that $300 million and apply it now to an export pipeline, you know, the same, you know.
I think we need to remember AGEA, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, which passed under the Palin administration. That act doesn't care where the gas goes. It's a decision by the state to underwrite the preliminary design, development, engineering, environmental work for a gas line from the North Slope. TransCanada, which got the AGEA license and the opportunity to tap into that $500 million in cost reimbursement, said, we'll take it to Tidewater for LNG in South Central. We'll take it to North America, wherever the market wants us. When they first advertised it, the market said North America. That's what they worked on with Exxon for a few years. That collapsed. Now they're looking at Tidewater, so it's still under the AGEA license. But I think, just a note, part of the problem was AGEA was oversold to Alaskans. AGEA was represented to Alaskans, if you do this, you get a project. Well, that was overselling. AGEA would help you get the building permit. That $500 million in state reimbursement that TransCanada and its partners could use to put together the material, to get a certificate from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for a project, all AGEA does is help pay the bill for a building permit. Not bad. You need a building permit to go along before you can build your house, but you got to get financing, and that's the tough part. And the financing is going to depend on the market and who's willing to write the check to take the risks, and that's the hang-up at the moment.
Well, TransCanada is a fine company, and they have a lot of experience building and operating and maintaining pipelines. I think that mm-hmm. they could do a great job. The lower 48 pipeline through Canada, I don't think makes sense now, but a pipeline to Tidewater, a large diameter pipeline to Tidewater and to our own markets here to take care of Alaska's needs and future needs, hopeful future needs, I think is paramount right now. And it's time to get this job done.
All right, Harry. Thanks a lot. What is, you know, sometimes, every once in a while a prospect comes up, hey, China could just finance the whole thing if it wanted to.
Well, I don't know if China wants to. You know, China produces 75% of its own gas, and as their demand increases and their production falls short, they're buying more gas. China last year imported about half of the gas China imported came by LNG, by tanker. The other half came by pipeline from Central Asia, from Turkmenistan. So China's not beholden 100% to LNG imports like Japan is. China has a lot of shale. If they can ever figure out and get their act together, they may produce their own shale gas. So China's certainly a possibility, but they also have options, be it their own gas, be it shale, be it pipelines from Central Asia.
Well, Bill Walker came in here and said, look, we could easily get long-term contracts with, say, Japan and Korea. You know, we're just not trying.
Well, I disagree. I think anybody can say what they want, but that's my view, talking to utilities, talking to people. Yes, Japan and Korea are the two largest LNG importers in the world. They have most of their gas needs under contract. They're looking ahead to the future, but we're going to have to compete on price because they're looking at Alaska. They're looking at half a dozen LNG import-export projects proposed for Kitimat and Prince Rupert, British Columbia. They're looking at LNG export projects proposed throughout the lower 48 on the East Coast, in Maryland and Georgia, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi. They're looking at new discoveries in Mozambique and Tanzania. They're looking at Russia. They will look for where they can get the cheapest price.
Oh, my God, I forgot all about the Panama Canal expansion.
Right, the Panama Canal will be expanded, deepened, widened, and you'll be able to take LNG tankers from Pascagoula, Mississippi, if they build the export terminal there, from Corpus Christi, from Sabine Pass, Louisiana, run them through the Panama Canal and bring them to Asia. Now, that's an advantage,
soon, right?
Certainly.
That's like a couple of years
away.
Yeah.
Right, the advantage for Alaska is even going through the Panama Canal, that is still a long voyage. And currently, charter rates on LNG tankers are about $120,000 a day. So Alaska has a disadvantage in that we've got to pay for an 800-mile pipeline through the Arctic to get the gas to Tidewater. But we have an advantage that liquefaction plant in Alaska is a lot closer than the Middle East or than the U.S. Gulf Coast or East Africa to Asian buyers.
And possibly more secure.
Possibly. Certainly politics enter into it too, or geopolitics, I guess, is the buzzword.
Yeah. We're speaking with Larry Pursley as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Well, we're talking Alaska's natural gas, what should be done with it, and it's always an illuminating subject. Our guest is Larry Pursley, Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, joining us by digital link from Washington, D.C., and by telephone from Sitka. Bob is on the line. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Thank you for having me on. Listen, I just wanted to give you a couple of things about the recycling of the gas on the North Slope. The first is that it doesn't just increase pressure in the well itself, and this because adding the low molecular weight hydrocarbon back into it also lowers the viscosity. So what it does is it permits the oil that's in the well to flow towards the wellhead in a little easier fashion.
Yeah, I tried to introduce that a little bit, and I know Larry's aware of that, but also that that figures well into the Badami situation right now, too.
Right. So if you start pulling it out, you're going to have less to do that. The question is, that extraction technology continues to evolve, so it's really difficult to know, well, I could do something else that would replace that that hydrocarbon ability to lower it with some surfactant or something that might allow you to pull more of that natural gas out of the ground and yet still get the same type of effect you want. They have two projects up there on the slopes to try and facilitate production. One is, of course, they add the bulk of the natural gas that they recover back down into the well, and then outside that there's a thing called a water wheel project where they actually pump water that they recover and pick up back down into the outermost perimeter. And again, those two, the water then forces oil towards the well, and the natural gas then helps to lower the viscosity.
Oh, yeah, that's what they're doing at Lisburn for a while now.
Okay, yeah. Now, while they slipstream the natural gas that they do to fire their furnaces and boilers and stuff up there, they don't flare that much. I want to say that probably most of the gas gets shoved back down into the ground, but a portion of it is burned in the various boilers. A portion of it is added back into the crude oil just before it enters the pipeline. Again, this is done to lower the viscosity of that crude oil as it's moving through the pipeline to keep it from seizing up.
Yeah,
and I think the percentage is around 5% or something like that. I'm not sure what it is, but there's a limit to it. Because the guys at the pipeline, they want oil. They don't want the gas. So, and then at the other end of the pipeline, there is a separation facility that recovers that natural gas. And I don't know what's done with it or how much they store at that particular line at the Anyway.
All right, Bob.
That's all I had to say about that. I hope it's informative.
Yeah, thanks for all those. Those are great engineering points. Love getting all those details. Alaskans are really great on that sort of thing, Larry. let's go to Robert, joins the program from Esther. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Robert.
Well, thanks, Steve. And hey, Larry, how's it going?
Oh, it's going well.
We haven't seen each other since the AHFC days.
Right.
Anyway, you could probably make a four-hour program here really easy, Steve, but Larry, I think you already answered my question here just by ESP or something. But basically, I'm really curious, being that the oil tax issue is such a timely thing right now, just how much of an influence, given the fact that, like you already stated, it's the worldwide market as far as availability, price, environmental issues, taxes, and the whole nine yards. How much does the tax issue really influence a gas pipeline? And that begs the question of decoupling the price of oil and gas and tax issues.
Well, I think it influences a lot, but not just in the way that most people think, which is
right.
How much tax is the producer going to have to pay on the natural gas it produces. If you have a natural gas line, you got to have the oil operations continue running just as long. You can't shut down the oil operations and just run a gas line. Oil and gas come up together. The gas is just not that profitable. It can carry all the cost of those field operations on its back. So if the companies decide to invest $50, $60 billion in a gas line that they hope to run for 50 years, that's also a commitment to keep all the oil field operations running for another 50 years. And I think that's more so where the oil tax issue comes in, that you've got to have the two running together, and it's going to take billions of dollars of investment by the companies to keep the oil operations going for 50 years, and that's where they factor in what's the tax going to be on the oil, like you say, separate from what you end up with for a fiscal structure on natural gas. The two have to run together.
So that's politically a huge, well, strategically too, I guess, the huge
issue.
Well,
politically and not economically.
Right, okay.
Yeah, you know, it's taken me forever to figure out that it's not that profitable to produce gas in Cook Inlet. The people exploring for gas in Cook Inlet are really exploring for oil because the price of gas is not high enough to justify the investment.
Right,
in the
but
well.
If you can find oil and gas and basically make the oil pay for your work that you're doing, then it's okay.
Yeah, then it's okay. Let's go to Don in Anchorage. Don, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. There seems to be something missing here in the equation. Along with the taxes and the money and all the middlemen involved in it, there was a situation here a while back where some folks were getting all kinds of revenue and money in from shipping oil and whatnot and having oil wells drilled. And what the party proceeded to do was take the revenues and build dams and hydroelectric projects along with solar and windmill projects throughout the entire area. A lot of people condemned the wisdom of some of that actions of that person. I'll grant you, overall, I might have had a real big ego, but the guy's name was Muammar Gaddafi. He was and did have concerns as far as investing for the future for his own country. I think that's where we're falling down here in Alaska. We need to throw some more emphasis on alternative energy resources. We know the oil is going to go. We know the gas is going to go. If we can export gas, great. But let's settle on some wise decisions and get going with the projects. I've been up here for over four decades, and I've seen an awful lot of waste just from procrastination and quibbling over who's going to get extra money and whose pockets it's going to land in. Anybody, it seems, but the taxpayer, as far as savings is concerned.
Thanks for the reminder, Don.
Well, we have a mayor out here, for one thing, who snubbed CIRI when it came to putting the windmills out on Fire Island. And he went thumbs down when the offer was made to MLNP for the power coming off of those windmills. And Chugiak jumped on it.
Yep. Good reminder, Don. Thank you. And I'm sure you're not the only person that's thinking that way. Larry Persley, Bill Walker is called in. Welcome to Talk to Alaska, Bill.
Steve, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Steve, thanks for having this show. It's a good topic to discuss. I always enjoy hearing discussions about this, and I always enjoy discussion with my friend Larry Persley. But I had to comment on one thing that was said, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
there was discussion about whether there's a market for Alaska's gas, and I've been a long believer of that, and it comes from about the last several years in the Asian market, meeting with companies in Asia. And the proof of the pudding was in the open season that took place on September 14th of 2012. Under AGEA, there was an open season, solicitation of interest. And the response needed for a successful project is 2.7 BCF. And the response received in written response to the open season from the Asian market was for 5.5 BCF, just double, 200% of what's necessary for a project. That's the good news, and it's the first time we've had some written responses that was ever made public, and we made it public because we're in my Port Authority hat. We're basically carrying the water for the companies that submitted their nomination to us, the volumes that they needed. And then the other company was Resource Energy, Inc. out of Japan, and they also submitted a nomination for 2.7 BCF. So that's the good news. That's incredible news. The bad news is nobody's heard anything back since that was submitted. We submitted the nomination on September 14th, and everything went quiet after that. No response back at all. And so I'm not sure what we're getting for our $500 million, but, you know, that's the problem. We're submitting our nomination to those that have competing projects around the world. I mean, Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips are wonderful companies, and we're very fortunate to have them in Alaska, but they've got competing projects everywhere in the world where they have to take the gas to market. They don't allow them to sit back and re-inject and study. But to answer the specific question on the market, there's a tremendous written interest of interest in the gas from Alaska because, as Larry said, it's conventional gas. It's not shale gas. I spoke at the World LNG Summit in Rome, and they were stunned that there was a conventional project left in the world. They thought it was all shale gas at this point. The projects, you know, Gorgon, Australia is about $55 billion LNG project, about a third smaller than Alaska, much less efficient because of the high temperatures, and yet they're signing up long-term contracts.
Okay, we're running out of time there, Bill. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Larry, you got about a minute here.
Sure. Yes, TransCanada and the companies went out for an expression of interest in 2012. Essentially, it's meaningless. There was not a dollar sign anywhere in there. It was just asking, hey, we're thinking of building this. Are you interested? We'll put your name on the list. Those are not commitments for binding long-term contracts to buy the gas at any price. So, yes, it's an expression of interest. That's it. It's not a sales contract. That's got to come later when they've got some dollar amounts to put on the price.
Thanks a lot for being with us, Larry. And thanks to Josh Edge, Dave Waldron, and the folks at Christian Science Monitor for making it possible. I'm Steve Heimel. See you next
week. Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.